This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Whether you love true crime or comedy, celebrity interviews or news, you call the shots on what's in your podcast queue. And guess what? Now you can call them on your auto insurance too with the Name Your Price tool from Progressive. It works just the way it sounds. You tell Progressive how much you want to pay for car insurance, and they'll show you coverage options that fit your budget. Get your quote today at Progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law.
It's the Kevin Sheehan Show. Denton Day sitting in for Kevin here on the team at 980. Mark Zuckerman from Seattle in about 30 minutes. But we'll go to the phones right now. Welcome in from CBS Sports, Jordan DeGianni. You can find him on Twitter at Jordan DeGianni. My friend, it's been a while. How are you?
Benson, what's going on, man? Hope you're doing well. Thank you so much for having me on the show. And I'm excited to break down Florida yacht parties and pink substances with you today.
We are going to break down some pink and maybe green substances because it looked like there was a multitude of stuff in that bag. Your reaction to how Mike Vrabel commented on the Stephon Diggs situation?
Classic Vrabel. I miss having him in Nashville. He's one of my favorite head coaches in the NFL. He talks about how his players need to make great decisions on and off the field. And he automatically just starts talking about what's going on in practice that day with the players who are in attendance for OTAs. But the bottom line is it's not a good look for Stephon Diggs, who signed something like a $69 million contract with New England, who clearly overpaid for an older wide receiver coming off of a torn ACL because they believe he can be an important part of the development of Drake May, who I'm sure most people would agree has a lot of potential, what he showed in his first season in the NFL. So not a good look for the Patriots, and it's not a good look that a new head coach has to deal with off-field drama before we even get to the preseason.
What did you think of maybe you didn't see this, but I guess I'll ask you this. Did you see that Stephon Diggs then spent all day posting his workout clips on his Instagram story?
That's a smart play. That's exactly what I would have done.
Guys, look, I'm still working out. I might have been on a boat this weekend, but I'm still working out. How necessary do you think he is to the development of Drake May?
Yeah, see, that's a good question, because not only is Stephon Diggs a really good wide receiver, and I understand, like I said, he's a little older coming off of that torn ACL, but the Patriots wide receiver room last year, in my opinion, was the worst in the NFL. And I understand they added a couple of pieces, such as Kyle Williams from Washington State, who a lot of people are excited about, was a draft crush of many. But Stephon Diggs is the veteran in that room, the established guy, the person who's led the league in receiving touchdowns or made multiple Pro Bowls. So when we frame it like that, I do think that Stephon Diggs is a very important part of the development for Drake May, but also what the Patriots want to do offensively. Even if he's not going to make the Pro Bowl in 2025, having a consistent pass catcher like Stephon Diggs, I think, was something that the Patriots absolutely had to do this offseason.
When Mike Vrabel was in Tennessee, did they have their own spin on the Patriot way?
Yeah, you know, it's a good question, because Vrabel's talked about it a lot. Like, Vrabel doesn't want to be known for being a part of Bill Belichick's coaching tree. And it's like, to his point, he never was a coach under Bill Belichick. But right. He also was a player under Bill Belichick for a long time. And I think a lot of people would agree that he acts like Bill Belichick. He doesn't like dealing with the media. He gives a lot of coach speak answers. And he's also a very smart head coach as well, who, you know, if you've watched Titans games in the past, he's used some kind of some things from the rule book that most people usually don't utilize or are even unaware of. So I think that Mike Vrabel reminded a lot of people of Bill Belichick. But at the same time, I don't think I would compare the way that the Titans operated to the Patriots' way. But maybe that's something that kind of changes now that he's actually back in New England. A Patriots legend is now running New England.
Final question on the Patriots and this whole situation for now. What is your level of optimism that Drake May takes a big step forward now that he is – has the entire offseason as being the starter in New England?
Yeah, I may not be the right person to ask, because I'm actually kind of a Drake May fan. Like, when he was entering his final season at UNC, I actually thought he was someone who could take over the QB1 spot from Caleb Williams potentially. That's how much I like this kid. I think he's a dual threat passer. I think he possesses the physical tools necessary to be a legitimate starting quarterback at this level. And watching Patriots games, which I'm sure not a lot of casual NFL fans did in 2024, I think he showed a lot of potential. And as I mentioned, he was dealing with a horrific offensive line, a coaching staff that was one and done, and the worst wide receivers room in the NFL as well. So the fact that he was able to show us a certain level of promise should have Patriots fans optimistic, especially now that they have Mike Vrabel in the building, who not only is just a Patriots legend, but someone who is known for being able to implement the stability that these lowly franchises are so desperately after.
Talking with Jordan Ajani here on the Kevin Sheehan Show with Denton Day sitting in for Kevin on the Team 980. You can find him on Twitter at Jordan Ajani. Big fuss here over the past 12, 18 hours, Jordan. Jalen Ramsey tweets that he's likely leaving Miami. Everyone thinks that Washington is a good landing spot for him. I'm a little slow. I'm hitting the brakes a little bit on that one. But where do you stand on the best fits for Jalen Ramsey? Is Washington one of them?
That's kind of interesting. People are talking about Washington with Jalen Ramsey. And maybe it would make a lot more logical sense to me if the Commanders did not just recently go after a veteran cornerback who was a former star in Marshon Lattimore at last year's trade deadline. So that's why Washington wouldn't jump off the page to me as an immediate fit for Jalen Ramsey, even though cornerback is, I guess, somewhat of a need. When it comes to the Commanders right now, I'd be hammering home pass rusher. I don't think they did enough at defensive end. But when it comes to Jalen Ramsey and other potential fits, to be honest with you, I'm already penciling him in to one team. And it's a team he's already played for, a team that appears to be all in for a Super Bowl in the NFC. That's the Los Angeles Rams. I think that the Rams, for multiple reasons, make a lot of sense for Jalen Ramsey. But they haven't been working hard to get a deal done, I guess I would say. Sean McVay's been asked about Jalen Ramsey multiple times this offseason. And by the way, you brought up that Jalen Ramsey took to social media yesterday to talk about how he's looking forward to the next chapter. I feel like he did that because he's not getting to that next chapter fast enough. We knew that Jalen Ramsey was going to be on the move for what seems like months, at least weeks at this point, and nothing has come to fruition. And there are multiple reasons why, not to go off on a tangent, but he's now the number three highest paid cornerback in the NFL. He just got paid like last year. He's averaging $24.1 million per year. So the money issues for whatever team wants to take him on is certainly a tough mountain to climb. But on top of that, Miami also wants adequate draft compensation in return for the services of their number one cornerback as well. So those are reasons why Jalen Ramsey hasn't been on the move just yet. I don't think he would come too expensive in terms of draft compensation. And again, I think the Dolphins would absolutely have to take on a good chunk of money to move him. But I would keep an eye on the Los Angeles Rams, maybe the Cincinnati Bengals, the Green Bay Packers with whatever's going on with Jaire Alexander. Those are a couple of teams to keep in mind.
You know, that's been my stance, is something you mentioned in there, is that the amount of draft compensation, like, they're not just going to give Jalen Ramsey up for like a fifth round pick. They're going to want a lot in return. Washington doesn't have a lot to give in return for that. And then the money is substantial. I mean, $24 million per year for a guy that's over the age of 30 at that position, where you tend to see a guy slow down a little bit, especially when physically they're not as fast as they once were. It just doesn't seem to make a lot of sense here. And then you and I are on the same page. They need more pass rushers. They didn't really address that this offseason the way that I thought they did. That's actually worried me a little bit with the way the Commanders have had this offseason.
Yeah, as it should. I mean, last time I was on the radio with you, we talked about pass rush kind of being one of the top needs for this franchise, and it seems like they haven't really addressed it. But, hey, I mean, Trey Hendrickson is still kind of out there. I'm sure that he obviously wants to get paid, which is something that could hurt Washington and their chances of acquiring him. But, I mean, you lose your leading sack king, Dante Fowler Jr., in free agency, and by the way, he had more sacks than the rest of Washington's defensive ends combined in 2024. Another name that I would put out there, and it's actually someone I mentioned for CBSSports.com, what about Jadeveon Clowney? I understand he's not some perennial Pro Bowl player at this stage in his career, but with the way Washington operates, could he be someone as a veteran option who would automatically improve this defensive line, which, by the way, I think ranks bottom three in containing the run in 2024. So Jadeveon Clowney is a name to keep an eye on as well.
If you had to pick between a guy like a Von Miller at 36, a Matthew Judon at 32, or a Clowney who's also at 32 but like 4 or 5 months younger, than Matthew Judon. Is Clowney the best bet of those three?
You know what's funny? I think I actually would pick Clowney. Like, Von Miller is obviously a Hall of Famer, but he's a little long in the tooth. Matt Judon is someone the Atlanta Falcons took a chance on last year in trading with the New England Patriots. He didn't really make an immediate impact. In fact, I think Atlanta arguably had one of the worst pass rushing units in the league in 2024. So Matt Judon is not that attractive of a name to me anymore. I think that it would be Jadeveon Clowney. And I understand if Washington would go that direction as opposed to trading for Trey Hendrickson, who wants something like $30 million a year. I would probably pick Jadeveon Clowney out of those three names.
Jordan Ajani, our guest here on the Kevin Sheehan Show with Denton Day sitting in for Kevin. When is Aaron Rodgers going to sign? Is Aaron Rodgers going to sign?
Dude, I'm so sick about, I'm sick of talking about Aaron Rodgers. You know, I will say this. Mike Tomlin had a famous quote during the Le'Veon Bell fiasco, and I can't help but think about it right now. We need volunteers, not hostages. And it's kind of annoying for the Steelers and their fan base to be held hostage by a 41-year-old player who's obviously now older, and he's polarizing at that. What exactly would Aaron Rodgers do to enhance the Steelers' ceiling in 2025? I would still view the Steelers as this team that might go 9-8, maybe make the playoffs, get blown out in that first round in a game that many people won't watch. That's still how I view the Pittsburgh Steelers. And here's something I will say, too. There's probably some kind of understanding between Rodgers and the Steelers behind the scenes, right? But there's no guarantee that's true. And from the outside looking in, the whole situation seems kind of silly at this point. What I continue to ask myself, and I'll ask publicly, is there a breaking point? Like, when would the Steelers be forced to change course and start paying more attention to Will Howard, or maybe even entertain trading for Kirk Cousins from the Atlanta Falcons? We're about to turn the calendar to June. There has to be some kind of breaking point for when they start just shifting their attention from Aaron Rodgers, because I'm sure you would agree, Denton, it seems pretty wild that we're still talking about this conversation.
I thought this was going to be over at the end of the draft. I thought he was going to sign like the next 2 or 3 days after that. Now we're at OTAs and he's doing podcasts. Ceremony. I don't know if it's a podcast, a festival with like Big Mike Studd. I don't even know if I want to know how that friendship came to be, but I did some research on Big Mike Studd. Wasn't familiar, not exactly like my and your age range, right? A lot of stuff made sense after. I was like, all right, yep, frat rap. That seems like Aaron Rodgers. That's right up his alley. It's just so odd to me. How much of this do you think is the ego of Mike Tomlin for wanting to maybe in the back of his head keep this streak alive of him consistently having winning records? Because it feels like at the very least, Aaron Rodgers would do, as you just mentioned, at least 9-8 if A-Rod is the quarterback.
Yeah, I mean, the streak is impressive, of course, but I feel like I would point more towards the Steelers just having as competitive of a football team as possible. That's what Mike Tomlin wants. You know, it's not about his historical streak. It's trying to chase Super Bowls. And, you know, there are people out there who still believe that Aaron Rodgers can play at a high level, and he had some pretty impressive performances during last season with the New York Jets, even though his tenure in the Big Apple was disastrous overall. So with a favorable position, favorable landing spot, I guess I will describe Pittsburgh as being, you know, they have gotten the best out of some quarterbacks such as Mason Rudolph before. They've added DK Metcalf. They've revamped the running back room. The offensive line should be more consistent. You know, you could talk yourself into Aaron Rodgers being, if he can just be a consistent quarterback and hit the shots that he needs to make, that Pittsburgh can be competitive. I think that's what Mike Tomlin is after. He wants to field the best football team possible. And at this stage in the offseason, you probably want Aaron Rodgers as your quarterback compared to Will Howard or Mason Rudolph.
Would you take Kirk over Aaron Rodgers if given the opportunity?
Well, it's funny because I've already hit my breaking point, as you can tell, with the whole Aaron Rodgers thing. So, yeah, I'd be turning my attention to Kirk Cousins. And, you know, there's similar to Jalen Ramsey, there's some money issues to work out there. And Atlanta reportedly has not been exactly flexible in those conversations behind the scenes in terms of how much money they're willing to take on. Of course, you've got to give up some kind of late draft pick as well. But yeah, I'd probably be turning my attention to Kirk Cousins at this point.
Why is Atlanta so stingy with this? Because it feels like at least getting some of that money off the books and not having to pay $40-some-odd million for a guy that you don't want on the field would be the better of the options. It feels like they're kind of doing a little too much right now.
So first of all, I kind of love that they're doing this because they're, you know, behind the scenes, they're not saying this, but the way I view it is, okay, Kirk, you tricked us into signing you to the most lucrative free agency contract last year, 4 years, $180 million, whatever it was. And it turns out that this Michael Penix Jr. kid from Washington is a better asset. So you're going to take your money, you're going to sit on the bench, and you're going to enjoy it. Now, naturally, that's not the way things are going. And ESPN actually had an interesting report last month saying that while the Falcons have been posturing as if Kirk Cousins being the number two and remaining on roster on that big contract is a legitimate possibility, that the Falcons secretly have recognized that their future is not tied to Aaron Rodgers and that it's probably better to move on from him. But again, the question is, when is the best time for that to happen? We all envisioned it would be after the draft because the Falcons would have a better understanding of the draft landscape. Maybe there's a team out there that could be more desperate for the services of Kirk Cousins. In terms of Kirk Cousins' viewpoint, he wouldn't be, as I like to describe, Kirk Cousins, where, you know, he signs with a team and then that team drafts a quarterback. So it was attractive for him to wait until after the draft as well. But many people were looking at the Cleveland Browns as a potential landing spot for him. But they ended up drafting 100 quarterbacks, including Shedeur Sanders, and now they don't really have a need for Kirk Cousins. So, you know, if you ask me where my money's at, I do think that we end up having a resolution to this whole fiasco soon enough. And again, I'll point to the Pittsburgh Steelers as kind of being the sleeper in this equation.
Every day, Jordan, I wake up and I pray. I was like, God, give me the challenge of my boss wanting to pay me $40 million to not work. Let me get that battle, please. I would gladly take that one. Like, I understand Kirk only has a couple good years left, wants to maximize it as much as he can before he eventually rides off into the sunset. I would have no problem if my boss said, we'll give you $40 million to not come to work or to come to work and not be a big deal. I could do that without ease.
That's the dream. That's the dream. Exactly right.
A couple more for you here. The best offseason has been had by which team so far in the NFL?
Oh, that's a good question. You know, I don't know if it would be the best in terms of the sheer amount of moves they've made, but I'm kind of really excited about the Los Angeles Rams, and they only have a chance to build on what I think has been a successful offseason with the acquisition of Jalen Ramsey as well. I feel like Davante Adams has a lot of tread left on the tires, and I feel like he is someone who is going to be the clear-cut number one for Matthew Stafford. You obviously have a Pro Bowl pass catcher already there established by the name of Puka Nacua. But guys, keep in mind, remember what happened last year with the Rams' young defensive front. They came one play away from basically hosting the NFC Championship game. In my opinion, the Rams are just right there. So with a guy like Puna Ford, Braden Fisk, Kobe Turner, Byron Young, Jared Verse, I'm really excited about what the Rams can be defensively in year two of this new era, if you will. But also, as I mentioned, offensively, I expect an uptick in production with the addition of Davante Adams and maybe that tight end Terrence Ferguson as well, the rookie who the Rams front office reportedly was really high on.
I won't hold you to it because it's only May, but I think the AFC is fascinating because there are four teams that are at the top, and this is the first year, at least in a little bit, where the Chiefs feel a little more human just based off of how their offseason has gone and how their season ended last year. Who wins the AFC?
Yeah, if you were asking me for my power rankings right now, I think I'd probably actually lean towards the Baltimore Ravens for a couple of different reasons. I think that with the addition of DeAndre Hopkins, I don't think DeAndre Hopkins is going to make the Pro Bowl by any means, but I think having that reliable pass catcher for Lamar Jackson is going to be very important. But defensively, you know, they made one of my favorite picks in the entire draft with Mike Green, the FBS's leading sack leader, I guess you should say, from last season. If Mike Green can be an absolute terror off the edge and be a legitimate defensive rookie of the year candidate with a healthy secondary as well in Baltimore, I think that the Ravens are going to be my pick to win the AFC.
I saw a picture of DeAndre Hopkins in that Ravens purple. It's impossible for a receiver to look like they're in their prime in the Ravens purple. Like, he looks older than he is. Jordan, we appreciate the time as always, my friend. Hope you're doing well. Enjoy the summer coming up here. And hopefully the storm season in Nashville is chill this year. I know it's been kind of weird recently.
Yeah, we've been getting crushed, man. But thanks so much for having me on the show. It's always good to talk shop with you, Denton.
That is Jordan Ajani, CBS Sports. Good enough to jump on with us here on the Kevin Sheehan Show with Denton Day sitting in for Kevin on a Thursday. Mark Zuckerman's going to join us in about 15 minutes. Coming up next, we will shift very briefly into some NBA postseason. It was a disaster last night for the NBA, something that needs to be fixed as soon as possible, if not sooner. Don't go anywhere. It's the Kevin Sheehan Show with Denton Day.
This episode is brought to you by Progressive. Most of you aren't just listening right now. You're driving, cleaning, and even exercising. But what if you could be saving money by switching to Progressive? Drivers who save by switching save nearly $750 on average. And auto customers qualify for an average of 7 discounts. Multitask right now. Quote today at Progressive.com. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National average 12-month savings of $744 by new customers surveyed who saved with Progressive between June 2022 and May 2023. Potential savings will vary. Discounts not available in all states and situations.
Kevin Sheehan Show. Denton Day sitting in for Kevin. If you like or love the NBA playoffs, last night sucked. I wanted a good game. It was over by the first quarter. Flipped that thing on. I was like, all right, here we go. Anthony Edwards, his response. Everyone, including me, was like, not the face of the league anymore. Not my face of the league. What is this guy going to look like? It wasn't good. 9 points in the first quarter. Nine
whole points.
What is this? Fifth grade basketball? 9 points?
I remember going to a JV girls basketball game in high school, and I think the final score was like 12-6.
That was basically what this first quarter was for one team. The Thunder didn't have any issues.
Seemed just fine.
They seemed just fine, but Minnesota couldn't do anything. And for a league that is seemingly in a free fall when it comes to ratings and interest and how to drive interest, how to get eyes on their product, there's been so much conversation about market size. Who cares about market size in 2025 of certain NBA teams? You could take a team from Bedford, Virginia, and if they're good enough with good enough players, people will ultimately watch the basketball. There are people in Maryland that are like, where is Bedford, Virginia? There are people in D.C. that are like, where is Bedford, Virginia?
There are people from Virginia going, where is Bedford, Virginia?
Bedford, Virginia is where I worked my first job. That's where that is. But you understand the point that I'm making. If you put a superstar on a team, people will watch it. It's selling stars, not selling teams, not selling jerseys, not selling cities. It made sense back in the way yesteryears, but even when I was in like middle and high school, because I couldn't watch teams across the country as frequently. Like when Gilbert Arenas was on this crazy Hibachi run, because I grew up on that big three of Gil, Kwan, and Caron Butler. When Gil was on this crazy run, he scored 60 against the Lakers. He scored like 54 against Phoenix. I think he had 40-something against Seattle in like a three-game stretch all the way back in what? That was 2006, I think. I was in middle school in the gold jerseys. That was extra fun for me because I got to see the teams on the West Coast that you could not regularly see in the NBA if they were not placed on national television. And at the time, national television was not as frequent as it is now. It feels like every single night in the regular season you get a nationally televised game, whether that be on NBA TV, ESPN, ABC, ESPN Plus, ESPN Deporte. Like, you understand.
CT ESPN.
I mean, Antonio Brown be standing in front of his league pass with his damn phone up, not recording the right way, but it'll still get you a game on live screen, right? So it was a lot more difficult back then to watch teams. But market size doesn't matter as long as the games are good. The problem is right now that Oklahoma City is so good that their games have kind of sucked because their best players aren't playing. And when you start it late on the East Coast, I mean, this one was 8:30. It was not terribly late. But once you start at 9, 10, 10:30, you do lose a little bit of your audience because people are going to bed. Now, I've always wondered this, Max, and we are not the right control group for this because we are like way deep into the sports. We're sickos. We also work weird hours, wonky hours. I'm so curious how many 9-to-5ers stay up past 10:30. Especially in this town when you got to wake up. Like, if you're a 9-to-5-er and you work in the city but you don't live in the city, you're probably getting up at the latest at 6:30, got to get ready, then got to get on the road and sit through a gargantuan amount of traffic because there's always traffic here, especially now
constant.
That people have to go back into the office. No one's staying up for these games on the East Coast.
Not a soul.
Because think about the East Coast and the markets that love basketball. It's New York, it's DC, and then maybe it's a little bit of Atlanta, Philly, what have you, but these are major cities that all have awful traffic patterns. So if you get up as a 9-to-5-er at like 6:30, you're not going to stay up until midnight. Or at least you're not reasonably going to stay up until midnight to watch games. So start times suck, but I get it. You got a West Coast thing, so you can't start a game in Oklahoma City at like 4:00. Understood. I get that. You can't start a game in Los Angeles at 4:00. Oklahoma City was a bad example because I think they're central time. But
they are.
Still, you can't start that game at 5:00 for me to start at 6. You have to kind of make it fit to your market side or to where your market is actually located. But the games have to be good. And when you have this team in Oklahoma City that the major television networks did an awful job, and they are partially to blame for this, they did an awful job of putting Oklahoma City on television and then promoting Oklahoma City as if Oklahoma City was a big deal. The mothership, I don't like watching the mothership's content on a regular basis, I admit. But First Take happens to be on. They are already having conversations of whether or not Oklahoma City is one of the best teams ever. How bottom of the barrel do we get here?
I have a defense for this from one NELL underscore BTP.
I saw this.
Yes. Him and Chris Russell are already getting their arguments underway.
A little too early for this for me, but go ahead.
Listen, I see ESPN and First Take have already run out of all their NBA topics from Chris Russell. Are the Oklahoma City Thunder already an all-time great team? He posted a GIF with Pauly Walnuts that says, get the out of here.
Blank?
Yes. And then Linnell responds, they won 68 games, had the best regular season point differential in NBA history. Double exclamation point.
That doesn't make them the best team.
No, not at all.
You got to win a championship first.
Correct.
You like the championship. This should be coming after the championship. You want to have that after you say, is this the greatest seasonal run? There's a conversation to be had there. I would still say no, but there's a conversation to be had there. You put this Oklahoma City, look, I'm as new school as you're going to get when it comes to basketball fandom. If you took this Oklahoma City team and put them against like the 96 Bulls, the conversation is going to be over very quickly. It's not going to be the same. The 96 Bulls are going to clear the Thunder. That's just going to be what it is.
Chet Holmgren getting bullied.
They're going to get bullied. It's not going to be like Chet Holmgren going up against any of the Bulls centers at that time. Maybe they'll throw Rodman on him just for funsies.
Yeah.
Like it wouldn't go well. But the conversation surrounding them is just, it's boring. Because it feels like the people that promote it don't watch it. And then when you have a blowout and Anthony Edwards doesn't play spectacular, he only has 19 points, it makes it all the more difficult. I mean, I turned this thing off at the end of the first quarter. It's like, I'm done. I got to wake up at 4 a.m. I'm not going to stay up to watch this trash. Because yesterday was trash.
It was.
But the Knicks-Pacers series has been really, really good.
Cinema.
Like, there have been games where the way that, like, you have to stay up for the entirety of it because not only do you want to see the ending, but you want to be involved in the conversation about the ending. That's where the NBA was at its best, at least for me when I was a little bit younger, at the birth of Twitter, when Steph Curry was at his peak, when Durant was at his peak, when LeBron was at their peak. When Steph had that game against Oklahoma City on a Saturday where he hit that shot from like half court, everyone was locked into Twitter. Everyone wanted to be a part of that. It felt like a big deal. The NBA has done an awful job this year in the Western Conference making it feel like any of the games are a big deal.
No Steph, they don't know what to do.
They don't know how to market new superstars. Life is so easy when you have this dude from Carolina whose dad was an NBA player that is shooting it from 30 feet and doing it 11 times a game. It's really easy to market that, but they don't know how to market new superstars. They're really good at marketing guys that do it all for them because they're just good enough in the way that they play. Well, Shai Gilgeous-Alexander is sensational. He's not the most marketable guy, so they got to put a little legwork in there, and they don't know how to do it, which is why you get, are they the best team ever? Maybe they're going to do something about Luka Doncic coming up here on First Take, because we all need to know about what Luka Doncic is doing this offseason. The combination of the promotion by the leagues that are in bed with the NBA, the people that are talking about the NBA, and then the actual game being trash, This is a W for those that hate when we talk about basketball on this program. This is a win for them because they get to point and say, see, I told you. And me, someone who's been a defender of the NBA, has to put his hands up and say, yep, I'm going to take the L here. With that said, I'm still excited for the Pacers and Knicks tonight. I have a play on that that you'll get before we close up shop here. But coming up next, we're talking Major League Baseball. The Nationals got a big-time win last night, 9-0 over Seattle. Mark Zuckerman is live from Seattle. He will join us on the other side. It's the Kevin Sheehan Show with Dent Day sitting in for Kevin on the Team 980.
All right, last night, the Nats, they get back in the win column, beating the Seattle Mariners by a score of 9-0. Robert Hassel with his first career home run in the big leagues, and Trevor Williams credited with the win. He had 6 innings pitched, gave up 3 hits, and 2 strikeouts. The Thunder, they crushed the hopes and dreams of the Minnesota Timberwolves last night, 124-94. The MVP, Shai Gilgeous-Alexander, led OKC with 34 points, 7 rebounds, and 8 assists. The Florida Panthers, they pulled it out in the third period. Caps killer Carter Verhaeghe scored the go-ahead goal. They close out the Canes 5-3, and tonight, the Edmonton Oilers will take on the Dallas Stars at 8 on ESPN, and the Pacers look to finish off the New York Knicks at the Garden tonight at 8 on TNT. This update is sponsored by the Team 980 YouTube page. Just open the app, type in the Team 980, and hit subscribe. Kevin Sheehan is live from 10 to 1 and Craig Hoffman from 4 to 7. Don't forget to like the stream and turn on notifications to stay up to date on all things DC sports. And that's what's trending.
This episode is brought to you by Progressive. Most of you aren't just listening right now. You're driving, cleaning, and even exercising. But what if you could be saving money by switching to Progressive? Drivers who save by switching save nearly $750 on average. And auto customers qualify for an average of 7 discounts. Multitask right now. Quote today at Progressive.com. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National average 12-month savings of $744 by new customers surveyed who saved with Progressive between June 2022 and May 2023. Potential savings will vary. Discounts not available in all states and situations.
Big win for the Nats yesterday. It's the Kevin Sheehan Show. Dent Day sitting in for Kevin. Nats got a 9-0 win. Another homer from James Wood. That's 15 on the year. That man is on fire. He's been sensational for the Nationals so far. Let's go live out to Seattle. Mark Zuckerman Masson with us here on the program. Mark, always enjoy having conversations with you and catching up. Hope you're doing well. Last night was a great one for Washington. Your biggest takeaway from the 9-0 win was what?
Just how they completely turned it around from the night before, Denton. I mean, you couldn't draw up a more polar opposite game from the series opener. They lost that one 9-1. They kind of looked lifeless. It was over from the beginning. And then last night they flipped the script. They scored early with back-to-back homers. They kept it going. They got a dominant start out of Trevor Williams for the first time this year. And then they cruised to victory. And it's kind of who this team is, for better or worse. I put out a stat that shows just how dramatic the difference is when they score first versus when the opposition scores first. You can usually tell by like the second inning what kind of night it's going to be. Last night was a good night and they got off to a great start.
How do they make what we saw last night a little bit more consistent? Maybe not the 9 runs, but they go through big losing streaks, then big winning streaks. And then last night, or the night before, it was 9-1, and this time it was 9-0. They were on the right side of it. How do they get more consistent?
Yeah, I think that's going to be a key. Some of it's just going to be experience. Yes, they have a bunch of young players who are still learning in the big leagues how to be a consistent player day in and day out, and it's not as easy as it sounds. So there is some of that, to be sure. I think the biggest thing has got to be when it comes to facing opposing pitchers. Yeah, you love to jump on them the first time through, but that's not always going to happen. You've got to be able to figure out, okay, if I didn't have a good first at bat, what's this guy doing? What kind of adjustments can I make the next time up so that it doesn't just become a fait accompli that if you don't get him early that you're not going to get him at all? It feels like there's been way too many nights where they get shut down, you know, 6 up, 6 down on 20 pitches. And then when they all come up again the next time up, nothing changes. And so I think that's something a lot of these guys need to learn how to be better at. Yes, they've had some success late against bullpens coming back, but you don't want to put yourself in that position. You'd rather, at least keep the game close or even take the lead in those middle innings. I think that's probably the next step for these guys to take.
How does the team, and I'm sure this is good, but I'll ask anyway, how does the team feel about James Wood through this portion of the season?
Oh, they don't think he's ever going to amount to anything. He's just, you know, he's a bust. No, I mean, I think everyone's in awe of it. It's really special to see this from a 22-year-old. And you know, the funny thing is, if you've been following this team over the course of two decades, it doesn't feel that unusual because we've seen it. We saw it with Bryce Harper. We saw it with Juan Soto. You can go all the way back to Ryan Zimmerman when he was young. Maybe not quite to this extent, but they've been spoiled. We've been spoiled by these young phenoms just bursting onto the scene and looking like superstars right from the get-go. And he, at this point, deserves to be in the same conversation. It doesn't guarantee that he will be over his whole career, but to hit the ball that hard, that consistently, to be able to hit it to all fields, left field, center field, right field, and to put up the kind of numbers he's got, he's on pace now for 44 homers and 118 RBIs. And he's going to challenge. He's not quite on enough pace yet, but he could challenge both those team records. Alfonso Soriano hit 46 homers way back in 2006, and then Anthony Rendon drove in 124 runs in the World Series year in 2019. And this kid at age 22 is on a pace to be right on par with, you know, some of the best seasons that this team's ever had.
Are people across Major League Baseball starting to look at him maybe a little differently? Not quite as a superstar, but a burgeoning superstar in the league?
Yeah, it's been fun to go around the league this year and see some of the visiting, or in this case, the home media, like in Seattle. And they've heard of him, and they kind of have a sense, oh, yeah, this is the big name guy on the team. And then they see him in person, and they're like, whoa, this guy is legit. That has absolutely been fun to see. And, you know, I was talking with someone last night that we're starting to get close to the point where we're going to be hearing about the All-Star game. Certainly he's, I'd have a hard time believing if he's healthy that he wouldn't be selected for it. But there's also going to be a question of the home run derby, I think, at this point. And I'm sure MLB would love to have a young 22-year-old burgeoning star in a marquee event like that. It may then come down to whether James and whether the Nationals wanted to participate in it. I hope he does, because I think that would be a great opportunity for anyone who's left out there that hasn't heard of him or doesn't fully understand who he is to get a chance to see him, you know, on the biggest stage like that with the biggest superstars in the game and really put on a show.
Does he have the personality and charisma to be on that stage and flourish as a superstar?
Well, you saw the Papa John's commercial, right? Some brilliant acting from him in that new pizza commercial. You know, he's not a big personality, and you can't force that. You know, he's going to have to be who he is. He's very calm and collected. He's a nice kid. He's not rude. He's almost overly polite. But no, he's not Bryce Harper, certainly, or Juan Soto when it comes to that kind of thing. And so maybe superstardom won't come as easily to him, and maybe he won't brace it as much. But seriously, watch that commercial, and you know, it just debuted yesterday, and he had a home run, of course, so that people get 50% off pizza because of it. There's like a subtle, like, wink-wink, kind of like, yeah, I know I'm not this overly dramatic, big personality guy, but I can have some fun with that, too. And, you know, I think he'll grow into it, I think, over time.
Mark Zuckerman with us here on the Kevin Sheehan Show with Dent Day sitting in for Kevin. Also last night, Mark, Robert Hassel hit his first homer in the bigs. Is he going to go back down when Cruz comes back up, or are they going to send somebody else down?
Well, it's up to him, really, and I guess Dalen Lyle to that extent, too, to kind of put the pressure on. And if they perform well enough, then by the time Dylan Cruz and Jacob Young as well, when they're ready to come back, there's going to be some decisions to make. If he has some more games like last night, he's going to find his way to stay up here. It was the home run is great, of course, first career one, but I think he was more impressed with the RBI single earlier in the game. He comes up with two outs. He's down on the count 0-2. He gets it to a 2-2 count and does what really throughout his minor league career he had shown he could do, and that's take a good quality at bat and hit the ball to the opposite field and then drive in a run. Cause it was at that point, it was still a close game. So kind of a key moment for him. And I think that more than anything is an indication of who he can be. The home run's great. And if he gets the right pitch, he can do that with it. But for him to stick up here, he's going to have to be able to show really what his natural swing is, which is to hit the ball to the opposite field. So far, so good. I mean, he had been in a little bit of a slump. It's only six games, I think. But last night, and he admitted this, he sort of felt more like himself again. And I think a big part of that was hitting, you know, actually two singles to the opposite field, including the RBI single.
If he does stay up when Cruz and Young get back, or maybe Lyle stays, maybe they keep four or five of them up, is James Wood the guy that would move maybe to first base and keep the other guys out in the outfield, or how would that rotation work back there?
Well, yeah, I don't see first base, not at this stage. I mean, they're really happy with what Nathaniel Lowe has done there. I think the DH question comes into play at that point. We have seen that when Josh Bell gets a night off, that James Wood generally has been the DH, and I think he's done it like 12 times maybe now, and he's had a lot of success in those spots. But I think they need to be really careful with this. You don't want to pigeonhole a 22-year-old into a DH role this right. early in his career. You know, yes, he is the inferior defensive outfielder compared to the other guys who are all really good, but you want in the long run for him to be comfortable enough in the outfield that you can put him out there on a regular basis and not just say, okay, you're going to be a DH for your entire career. So I'll be interested to see how that all plays out. I could see a scenario where they ultimately have, say, four quality outfielders, and I would hope they would use the DH position to kind of rotate them all around and give everybody a chance to maybe take a day, you know, a half day off, as you call it, where you're still engaged in the game and still hitting, but you're not on your feet as much. You're not in the outfield as much. I'd rather see that than them just pick one guy to do it. Now, Josh Bell will have a say in that as well, and he finally had a big night last night.
Finally,
he needed it.
Yeah.
Three hits, big home run. You know, I'm not going to declare anything with him until he does this over a longer stretch, but he desperately needed that one and maybe, you know, to stave off these questions that we're having right now.
What was the response, now that it's been a couple of days inside the clubhouse, around the organization, about the scathing Ken Rosenthal piece about how long this rebuild has taken?
You know, I think a lot of people had a similar reaction to me, which was, yeah, there were a lot of valid points in there, but why now? That felt like something that could have been written 2 years ago, even 3 years ago, and would have been just as relevant, as opposed to right now when, sure, they have a lot of work still to do. They still have to prove a lot that they can finish the job on this thing. But I think anybody objectively would look at the situation that the Nats are in right now and say they're in a much better position than they've been since the rebuild began, and that you know, they're drafting and developing, while a major problem for a long time appears to be getting better, that the young talent they put on a field now on a nightly basis is, you know, way better than where they were not that long ago, and arguably this is the most young talent they've ever put on the field at the same time, even in the years that they were winning as much as they were. A lot of that was free agents and more veteran players. This is all young talent that's either homegrown or acquired via trades. So I think the feeling is they're in a much better position now than they had been. So why pick on them now for that? It seems like those points could have been made a while back. And frankly, a lot of us in the DC media had been making that point for a while. It's almost like Ken Rosenthal, who is a great writer. He's the most respected guy in my business. So I can only imagine how hard it is to keep tabs on 30 teams and be an expert on 30 teams.
Right.
But it kind of felt like a guy who maybe hasn't paid much attention to the Nationals since the Soto trade, finally getting caught up on things.
Yeah, I had a similar thought. I was like, if you would have written this, you know, a year or two ago, I guess it would have made sense. But it feels like, especially the way that James Wood is playing now, the homegrown talent is rising as the team is expected to rise.
Right, and I mean, include C.J. Abrams, Mackenzie Gore. I know Dylan Cruz hasn't been everything he could be, but there's still good positive signs there. And even, you know, when it comes to the drafting and developing, which I said was, yes, a major concern and maybe the biggest reason that they did trade Soto, because they had not done a good enough job of bringing up that next wave of young players. But look at where we are right now, where Brady House and Cade Cavalli, a couple of first-round picks, are on the verge of making it up here and looking like they could be something big. They have the number one pick this summer. They are developing guys who weren't blue-chip first-round picks, like Jake Irvin, you know, even Jacob Young and Mitchell Parker to an extent. So I just I thought it came across as someone who maybe hasn't been paying as much attention recently to the strides they have made in all those areas. I think the Nationals internally realized where they were failing in a lot of ways and have taken some steps to try to get better at that. Now, they still need to finish the job. And, you know, if at the end of this year, we're still talking about a team that's winning 70 games and hasn't taken that next step, and if ownership doesn't at some point here start giving Mike Rizzo the resources that they used to give him, then I think it's fair to come back to all these points and say, is it ever going to happen again? But right now, I think we're kind of in that middle ground where you're not sure, and you can say, like, in general, I feel like the trajectory of the organization is on the up right now, not on the down.
Is there a magic number to keep Davey going into 2026? I know he signed a two-year extension in 2023. That would be up at the end of this year with a club option for 26. Is he going to be the guy that takes this next step with the organization when they're ready to?
You know, I've felt all along going into this year that there should be pressure, not just on Davey, but really on everyone in the organization to show real improvement this year. Now, I mean, yeah, it comes down to wins and losses, and you'd like to think that has something to do with it. And, you know, the hope would be that they are close to, if not even surpassing the 500 mark, although I don't know if it has to boil down to that. You know, I think there is a scenario where they win 76, 77 games, something like that, and maybe you're disappointed with the record, but you can honestly look at the improvement on the field and the talent they have and say, okay, yeah, things are still going in the right direction. That's why we want to keep this group together. But yeah, I felt like coming into this year, this is a critical year. It's time for that rebuild to move into a winning direction. And, you know, they have the young players now that make you believe that it should be better. You should be seeing better results. They're not all the way there yet, as I said, but, you know, another 71 kind of win season, it could be tough to make the argument that everyone, and that's not just Davey, that's a lot of people, that everyone deserves to continue on this path. They've been given the time now to bring this team back from the dead. It's time to see the results on the field.
Well, hopefully tonight the results look a lot like they did yesterday. Mark, appreciate the time as always, my friend. Enjoy your time out there out west.
All right, you got it. Thank you, Den.
That is Mark Zuckerman of Masson, who is good enough to jump on with us here. He's there in Seattle. The Nats in action tonight, 9:40. It'll be on FS1 on television. You'll hear it on our sister station, 106.7. The Fan, taking on the Mariners before they head still out west but down south to take on the Arizona Diamondbacks. Coming up next, there's been a lot of changes in college football. There's a lot more changes on the horizon in college football. Shehan J. Araja from CBS Sports is going to join us to make sense of it all and what is the next logical step for the fate of college football. Don't go anywhere. It's the Kevin Sheehan Show with Denton Day on the Team 980.
This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Whether you love true crime or comedy, celebrity interviews or news, you call the shots on what's in your podcast queue. And guess what? Now you can call them on your auto insurance too with the Name Your Price tool from Progressive. It works just the way it sounds. You tell Progressive how much you want to pay for car insurance and they'll show you coverage options that fit your budget. Get your quote today at Progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law.